The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we still,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Hello, Zero Books readers and listeners. This week's podcast features a conversation with Benjamin Reynolds, whose book, The Coming Revolution, was published last June by Zero Books. We discuss fully automated luxury gay communism, value theory, labor vouchers, and socialism as a political project. It's Thursday, November 29th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're a fan of this podcast, you should consider supporting us on Patreon. You'll gain access to a second podcast every week, and starting in the new year, you'll get access to a monthly members-only video tutorial on socialism, philosophy, or both. We have several big projects in mind for 2019, including our Realizing Philosophy series, a series of podcasts outlining the history of the socialist left, and the production of a longer documentary-style video, at least one, probably a series of those. Supporting us on Patreon will both make these efforts possible and give you the opportunity to both listen to and watch what we come up with. We currently have just about 500 patrons. Our next goal is to get to 600. I should also point out that Benjamin Reynolds' book is the current Zero Books Club title. So if you enjoyed this podcast, you should consider signing up for the book club through Patreon. In this podcast, you'll find a remix of Radiohead's Fitter, Happier. Only the lyrics have been changed. The music you're listening to right now is an 8-bit version of Imagine by John Lennon. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing from Benjamin Reynolds as we discuss automation and communism.
Yeah, sure. It's nothing too fancy in the introduction. I'm just a writer, an activist. I grew up in the D.C. area, lived in New York for a little bit where I did different kinds of activism work, was in London for a year and now back in the States. And that's pretty much it.
Okay. And so how did you come to write The Coming Revolution for Zero Books?
So I got the idea for the book a while back, like at this point, probably 6 years ago. But I really started working on it in earnest when I got into doing activism work in New York. And we were dealing with all kinds of different issues, from police brutality to campaigning for tenants' rights against gentrification. And I realized that while people were operating from a position where they were very critical of capitalism, there wasn't necessarily a really good understanding of why capitalism nowadays was working the way that it was. And so the point of sort of taking this deep delve into trying to understand how global capitalism is developing was to be able to provide that kind of understanding to people as they're doing their work.
Now, you start your book claiming that you're pretty convinced that automation will help lead us towards a socialist future. Why don't you expect another world war that will destroy enough capital to make another boom possible rather than a socialist transformation?
Oh, I think that's entirely possible. So my argument is not exactly the same as, you know, a lot of the catastrophist arguments that you would have heard at the start of the 20th century from people like Rosa Luxemburg or Lenin or Trotsky, where they'd say it's inevitable that right now we are in the era of transformation to a socialist economy. I think it's very, very possible if you look at the rising tensions between different competing world powers that we could actually have another global conflict at some point in the medium to long term future. The thing is that even if you do have that kind of wiping clean of capital slate, the process of accumulation that's going to happen after that due to the technological developments that have happened since the last century is going to be much, much faster. So I don't think that it's going to provide that much of a respite relative to what happened after World War II.
I mean, that was fairly quick too, if you believe the story that, you know, the decline in the rate of profits started in the 70s. I mean, that it, the decline in the rate of profit started to have dramatic economic effects in the 70s. If you believe that, that's what's that? Three decades. So that's not that long. And you're quite right. I mean, I don't believe that we could have a war that would wipe out the technological know-how to develop the automation that we have. But we could have one that wiped out the infrastructure.
Yeah, if we did have that kind of war, I think we'd be talking about completely different questions about human social development, you know, setting us back a very, very long ways.
But it's still unclear to me, because there's such, well, you hold with the labor theory of value, correct? So it seems to me that whenever there is such a speed up in automation and speed up in production, that you're going to have an economic crisis, and that would be a countervailing force away from automation. But I guess right now you don't see that happening. So could you just spell out to me how you believe that this process of, I mean, how we're going to get to fully automated gay communism? Luxury communism.
Yeah, I mean, that is the dream in a sense. I think, as you say, there are a lot of contradictory and countervailing factors. So one of the things that's really interesting about what's happening right now and what's been happening over the past decade is that you have the development in terms of technological capacity of a lot of different, increasingly powerful technologies for automating all kinds of different work. But the investment hasn't actually really gone that much into putting those technologies into use in a lot of different sectors. And that's what, when mainstream economists complain about low productivity growth, that's really what's happening. The sort of irony is that when you have a long period of a decline in the power of labor and organized labor for reasons of increased capability of offshoring, for reasons of previous drives towards automation, the reduction in wages that's happened has actually made there less of an incentive to introduce these kinds of technologies until wages actually start rising again, until people actually start struggling and fighting for, you know, a decent life and better conditions in their workplace. There's actually a reduced incentive. So I think that's actually one of the things that's acted as a brake thus far in the progress of automation. But I think if we look historically over time, it's never a straight line between a technology being invented and it's instantly implemented across entire industries, entire sectors. It's a very, very rocky process that happens in fits and starts, perhaps with people or firms that have a particular use for a technology. But eventually the technology becomes cheap enough, as we saw, you know, with the use of tractors and other mechanized equipment in American agriculture, where you just simply cannot profitably compete using any other technology. And that's kind of the concern that I'm trying to point to in the book, is that this process that's been going on first in agriculture and then in the industrial sector in different industries has the capacity to move into the rest of the economy as well. When the technology gets there, when there's a level of worker struggle that actually impels companies to try to fight back by introducing this automation, it will happen. So it's a question not of whether it will, but when.
You tell a compelling story, and I really would recommend, by the way, people pick up The Coming Revolution. But I'm just a little unclear about, basically, I've remained unclear about how to understand the Industrial Revolution in terms of how it developed. For instance, whether it developed as a political project first, or whether it was, you know, there's some stories that say that the precursor to the Industrial Revolution was Martin Luther and the change in the way that people related to God and Christianity, taking a more individual approach to their relationship to God rather than going through the hierarchical authorities of the church, for instance. And there's the story that you tell, which is the story of technological innovation with the printing press sort of coming to dominate the culture in terms of media and, you know, propagating information, but then taking on a more central role to production in general, that the way that we produced a book became the way that almost everything was produced in industrial society.
The argument that I make in the book is that if we look at the development of the printing press, which is actually really the first instance of mass production being done, well before what we traditionally think of as the Industrial Revolution. We see, and also in the social relations that exist and are created in printing houses, we see a kind of image of the industrial society that we now live in miniature. So you have these printing houses where, because of the expense of the equipment, you have an early capitalist who invests in the printing house, employing journeyman wage laborers who basically engage in a very early form of kind of proto-syndicalist struggle. And this is back in the 1500s. So this is way, way before the first syndicalists really got around. And you also have just at a technological level, at the level of production, you have a machine-aided production that's using these forms to create many, many, many copies of the same thing in a process that was previously dominated by artisans. Strives down the cost of the product, which we've seen with every mass-produced good. It necessitates the creation of much, much larger distribution networks to absorb all of these new products that are being created. And it really changes the social relations at the point of production and the kind of relationship that consumers have with this product. So the argument is that this is not industrialism in itself. That what happens is that this kind of paradigm of producing things eventually gets spread with the creation of other technologies to different industries. Now, the argument is not just that technology itself drives the development of a new kind of mode of production. It's a multifaceted process. So on the one hand, you have the technology, and on the other hand, you have the social relations. So it's not necessarily the case that we would have had to have industrialism developed in a capitalist way. You could have used industrial technology in a way that was more liberatory if the social relations of the time were more equal and you didn't have these dominant classes that were capable of monopolizing control of the means of production. So I do try a little bit to avoid that sort of teleological technologist explanation in the book.
Well, I don't think we should ignore that approach. You know, I mean, I'm not trying to just ignore the role that technology plays. And I tell you, if you look around today for something hopeful that might presage socialism developing, it would be the great strides we've made, say, in telecommunication technology and with the internet to connect people. And just the general increase in automation does seem to point in the direction of a massive change in the way that we work and produce the world. But it's just striking how for so long technological innovation in and of itself hasn't liberated us. And, you know, Marx has a good explanation of that in Capital. You know, the technology isn't designed for that purpose. So I feel as though, of course, we're going to have to consider and develop a political project in order to transform the technological production that we perform. We have to change what we make and what we think that we are aiming to do with the technologies we create. But you kind of would claim that some of that is already going on, that the personal computer presaged a change in production and that this change can be seen in distributed production.
Yeah, so the argument that I make in a way that, you know, I'm analogizing with the printing press earlier is that essentially, a computer that's connected to the internet is very much like a printing press in terms of what it allows you to do. It allows you to produce media and distribute it. The thing is that it's happening in a different fashion. The computer is a tool that you have as an individual. It's not something that is owned by a capitalist as a very expensive machine. It's something that you can use as a consumer product. The distribution network is also very different. You can instantly distribute the codes that allow people to reproduce the things that you're creating for free, basically, for a very, very, very small cost over the internet. And that is a radical, really is a radical thing. And it's obviously, there's also a lot of negative things associated with the internet as well, which we've all learned over the past few years. But if you look at projects, I mean, again, this is like stuff that everybody knows about. You look at projects like Wikipedia, which is not perfect, but which is based on people volunteering their time to create this database of knowledge. You look at software development projects where, again, people are freely giving their talents to something and then freely giving the product to the rest of the people. That is a sort of, in my opinion, that's a sort of communism in embryo. I think that this new form of production obviously is not going to really flourish to its full capacity as long as it's within the old system where people still have to work for a wage. You know, you can't make money editing Wikipedia. You're not going to be able to feed yourself by editing Wikipedia. And that's still a social reality that we live with. So as you said, technology is not neutral. So technology, you know, unveils new kinds of possibilities for us as a people, as a species. But at the same time, technology has never had the capacity to liberate us on its own. We do need actually a kind of new political project that will allow us to unleash all of this capacity that we have and not simply unleash it in the way that's actually most detrimental to working people.
Well, what would you say to someone who objected that the problem was not merely social relations, but also the step from this immaterial form of distribution and production to a material distribution and production? In other words, you know, it's very easy to distribute a text or now an audio file or a video. Images and ideas can be thrown around the world in seconds. But people don't just live off of, you know, Facebook chats. They require food and shelter and clothing. And not only that, the infrastructure to support the networks of computation, you know, are also physical, and they require all sorts of obscure and difficult to obtain minerals and composites, and I don't even know what all. It's all magic to me, really. But what would you make of the argument that this form of production that the computer networks represent just will never translate over into the material world?
I mean, I think we're starting to see already the ways in which this kind of distributed production can actually create physical products. And so the example that I use in the book is the 3D printer, which everybody's heard people singing the praises of. As it exists now, 3D printers are pretty expensive and they can do limited things based on what they are, but we're seeing the development of more and more sophisticated machines. And over time, these machines are going to be better and they're going to be cheaper, much in the same way that regular printers and regular computers got much better and much cheaper over a series of decades. I very much think that we could very easily live in a world where decent sized products can be made in your own home by a printer that you own. That said,
or that someone could print their own home.
Well, yeah, actually quite. There is a system that already exists where people print, it might not necessarily be the most aesthetically pleasing home. It's, you know, it's made out of printed concrete, but there's already, you know, massive printer nozzles that are used by I think it's a Chinese firm, but I'm not 100% sure, to create these houses. But that said, it's not that when you have a new kind of new way of producing things, producing goods, that it completely gets rid of all of the old ways of producing things. It basically forms an additional layer on top of the previously existing ways of producing things. So the rise of industrialism didn't get rid of artisan production. The rise of distributed production is not going to get rid of industrial production. We're also going to have highly automated, highly centralized production facilities as well. That's just a reality. I don't think we're going to get to a point until we get to somewhere where, you know, we have technologies we can't even dream of, where people are like printing, you know, Boeing 747s in their living room. That's just not going to happen.
What about like something like a replicator from Star Trek where you can print a meal?
See, that is the dream. I mean, for those of us who like cooking, I mean, maybe that would take something out of existence and we'd have to, you know, keep that for ourselves. But no, that is kind of where this technology is pointing as a distant possibility if we actually manage to surmount all of the challenges that we're facing as a species on this planet in the next century or so. I mean, the world that our descendants could live in really could be something quite wondrous.
How does distributed production overcome what Hayek called the knowledge problem? Hayek said no central planner or even network of central planners, maybe, will ever be able to have enough information to know exactly how to calibrate production, where to send inputs and outputs, and how to, in a controlled, rational, conscious way, produce and distribute the things of life. And that it's the market system, according to Hayek, that can step in and mediate those decisions for us in a distributed way, I guess. and so that, you know, it's the inputs and outputs come from the free actions of individuals in the market rather than from some centralized planning committee. That would be Hayek's knowledge problem.
Yeah, I don't want to make too many enemies here, but I'll just go ahead and say I'm not the world's biggest fan of planning. I think distributed production on its own quite obviously is a system based on that isn't really based around centralized planning. It's based around cooperation coming from individuals or groups of individuals to work on projects that people agree are necessary, and people take things as they will. Again, to me, that's a pretty pure form of communism, and it seems good. It seems to work, at least in the areas that it's been tried out. And as it expands, we'll see if there need to be additional constraints, like, you know, regulations placed on that when we're dealing with physical goods. But I think the left's interest in planning, especially from the beginning of the last century, kind of comes from a time when there actually really were serious economic dislocations caused by just the inability of private capital to plan how much they were going to produce versus how much consumers would actually be able to consume. Do we still have that problem? Probably less so with the kind of distribution technologies that have been developed nowadays. I think that planning as a society in terms of coming together democratically and saying, here are the kind of things that we want to invest in is a good thing. But in terms of saying to, you know, having a central body that says to firm X, you need to produce, you know, this many cars because we've calculated that this is the exact number of cars that people are going to need, that doesn't really seem particularly necessary.
You're conceiving of the technology where production is so easy that the problem of distribution would disappear.
It's not that the problem of distribution will disappear. I'm just arguing that nowadays we have sophisticated enough distribution technology and logistics technology that, say, if we had a socialist economy where there was public control over investment, but that firms were basically operated and controlled by the workers in those firms would be able to figure out well enough, based on the information they got from transportation companies and from their logistics networks, what they needed to produce without being told by a centralized body, how to go about that actual, like, the micro process of producing some number of widgets.
And how would they know what they needed to produce, those firms, if they weren't producing for the market and to meet demand in the market?
Well, this is the question of transition, right? So do we have an immediate leap from a capitalist system to a fully communistic system? If it is possible, absolutely we should do it. That said, it might also make sense to have a transitional period where, in spite of the fact that the firms are owned and operated by the workers, in spite of the fact that the capital in the society is controlled publicly by the society as a whole, there's still means of account like money to ensure that people are actually able to get the things that they need and goods are being produced to meet those needs. In the book, I do talk about during the Spanish Revolution, there was actually a lot of experiments with abolishing money taken by the various anarchist collectives that were in the countryside in Barcelona. What they found, even though they were conducting production on a cooperative basis, was that they actually needed to reintroduce money in most cases, except for goods that were so abundant that there was simply no need to keep track, which is like bread at that time period.
So they needed the money in order to make sure that people didn't hoard, or they needed the money just to make sure that they could keep good account of where what had been produced had gone?
Yeah, you needed money to basically clear transactions between the different cooperatives. So, you know, Cooperative X gives you some number of machines, you give them some number of whatever good you're producing. You need a way to figure out how much those things are worth. And you need a way for people who are working in the cooperatives to get a certain amount of goods from a place where these goods are like potentially scarce and not essentially limitless from your practical purposes, which bread would be the counterexample of something that they were able to produce enough of that everyone could just take what they wanted. You needed some kind of system of adequately adjudicating that issue. And they reintroduced money in most instances.
So have you spent any time thinking about or reading about Marx's conception of labor notes?
Yeah. I mean, if you think I don't want to go – so it's complicated now because we have a system where we have fiat currency. But before the existence of fiat currency, what was a, you know, a dollar or a pound but a labor note? I mean, that is the sort of essence of Marx's argument about commodity money, right? That its value is comes from the fact that it's tied to definite labor.
He receives a certificate from society that he has furnished such and such an amount of labor, after deducting his labor for the common funds. And with this certificate, he draws from the social stock of means of consumption as much as the same amount of labor cost. The same amount of labor which he has given to society in one form, he receives back in another. Here, obviously, the same principle prevails as that which regulates the exchange of commodities, as far as this is exchange of equal values. Content and form are changed, because under the altered circumstances no one can give anything except his labor, and because, on the other hand, nothing can pass to the ownership of individuals, except individual means of consumption. But as far as the distribution of the latter among the individual producers is concerned, the same principle prevails as in the exchange of commodity equivalents. A given amount of labor in one form is exchanged for an equal amount of labor in another form. Hence, equal right here is still in principle. Bourgeois right, although principle and practice are no longer at loggerheads, while the exchange of equivalents in commodity exchange exists only on the average and not in the individual case. In spite of this advance, this equal right is still constantly stigmatized by a bourgeois limitation. The right of the producers is proportional to the labor they supply. The equality consists in the fact that measurement is made with an equal standard, labor. But one man is superior to another physically, or mentally, and supplies more labor in the same time, or labor for a longer time, and labor, to serve as a measure.
Yeah, so it seems like the principal difference is that instead of having this one unit of account where, you know, the wage that you receive is the exact same thing as what's circulating between banks, it's still fundamentally the same unit. You're getting a voucher, which is different from whatever unit of account is being used for transactions between businesses or transactions between whatever entity is controlling the public's store of investment funds or capital. I think it could work. Having not really given too much thought to this already, I'm not going to go ahead and, you know.
Yeah, do you think that fits into your vision? I mean, that of how technology can transform society, that we wouldn't need, because of the abundance of distributed production, we wouldn't have as much of a need for anything beyond a labor note?
So I think that the obvious ideal to which we aim is to have a society where we really don't actually even need anymore these sort of accounting mediums or things that are based around scarcity, artificial or otherwise, where people can take and get what they need and receive it freely. You need to introduce these things if you have a system that has meaningful scarcity, or you have a system where you still need to function along a capitalistic basis because your economy really isn't developed enough to the point where you can actually have that kind of sort of abundance. I think that given realistic ecological constraints, there are always going to be things that remain scarce. So we will always need some kind of way of figuring out who gets what when things are scarce, or making sure at least that, you know, if there's enough for everybody to have one of something, you don't have one person who hoards like 1,500 things.
Right, but that may not be money. I mean, that could be, depending on the what things are scarce and how they're produced and the political structures in the future, that could be just decided by some board or something that, oh, you know, everyone can't get, you know, everyone should have access to one dilithium crystal, say, something like that, just to stay in the Star Trek mode. Those will be distributed, you know, through the Federation to every household and, you know, once every 6 months. You know, and that may change, you know, as the production of dilithium changes or whatever. But you know, that I could see something, a decision like that being made by a council or some centralized committee, whereas other products that are printed in your home or grown in the fields at a fast rate wouldn't need to be managed that way.
Yeah, no, I mean, that sounds pretty pretty reasonable to me. I think to go back to the question of the labor notes issue, just from an individual's perspective, let's say, you know, you're a worker, you work in a factory that produces some kind of processed food, right? The difference to me as the worker here between receiving a voucher that lets me buy stuff and receiving wages that I'm setting with my comrades in the workplace is pretty minimal. It's a question of what kind of economic system it necessitates either kind of thing. Do we have a system where we need to have a separation between these vouchers that people are receiving and what is functioning now, where capital used to function in the capitalist system? Or do we have a system where it can be the same unit of account? As an individual, the more relevant questions are things like, how much am I being compensated? How much control, real control, do I have in my workplace and within the economy at large? How much control do I have as a political member of my community and as the larger community of which I'm a part? I'm not too convinced just thinking about it immediately, the necessity of this kind of like labor notes convention.
Okay, so let's shift over and talk about the politics of the present. Let's talk about socialism as a not as a future society, but as the process of transformation happening within capitalism. One of the claims you make in your book is that the working class has been under assault, possibly partly because of the contradictions that are involved with in a world that's automating. So, you know, you have more and more automation that cheapens the price of the goods that are produced, but it also lays a lot of people off. It creates massive unemployment. It also may bring down wages, maybe even faster than the prices are dropping. And according to you, just the standard of living for working people has dropped significantly, say, over the last 40 years.
It's been stagnant in most places, I would say. It really depends on the class fraction. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Okay, so it's the standard has been stagnant, and that is perceived as a drop because the standard of living for the working class has remained stagnant, but the amount of production has increased dramatically. So the amount of wealth in the world has increased. The kinds of things that you can do has increased. We are living in a world of plenty in one way, in another, the working classes there's more inequality. A centrist Hegelian philosopher like Fukuyama would point out that what we're really experiencing is a general rise in living standards internationally. And there are statistics to back that up, that say the life expectancy in China or India has increased, or the wages. Just you can look at the amount of money that people live off per day has increased significantly in just the last 20 years. But what this has come along with is a general increase in inequality in first world nations, and that's what we're really experiencing, say, in the United States. It's not that there's been a general stagnation and relative decline, but that there's been an increase in inequality in the Western world.
I would say that the Western world side of the argument is largely correct, though more complicated. The developing world argument is actually something. So I was actually somewhat inclined to be sympathetic to the idea that wages were broadly rising in the developing world due to the pace of development that's going on in many countries. I also, you know, have recently encountered a wonderful book by this academic named John Smith. It's called Imperialism in the 21st Century. You could almost say it's a perfect companion to my book, given how similar the titles are. But what he actually goes to show, what he does is that he shows that what's been happening in the developing world, except for China, and China's a very interesting exception, is actually somewhat similar to what's been going on in the Western world, where you've had radical rises in the standard of living for the people who are at the very top of societies in much of the developing world. But that actually workers in most developing countries haven't really seen a significant improvement in their standards of living, except China. And that's the thing that's really interesting, is that a lot of the discussion about the improvement in the standard of living for working people in the rest of the world is true for China due to a lot of factors, including the incredible militancy of laborers there who have engaged in thousands of wildcat strikes over the last decade and have actually managed to push up factory wages. And also there's been a rising middle class in other sectors as well. That's really not true in most other countries.
So that it's just China mostly that's bringing up the overall global
average. And the global average is also being brought up by the capitalist class in developing nations. So you have this same process of expanding inequality going on actually in countries that are very, very different otherwise economically. You know, the U.S. and a country in sub-Saharan Africa are actually quite likely to look very similar in terms of their charts about how much inequality has been rising, which is something that actually surprised me a lot when I read his book. So kudos to him. I mean, he did some phenomenal work with the data.
What about just general life expectancy? You wouldn't think that would be able to be tinkered with quite the same way that wages or income, because if you have a class of people who are driving around in Mercedes Benzes and have personal jets, that might bring up the average income for the whole country, but it wouldn't bring up everyone's life expectancy.
No, it is absolutely true that there have been certain improvements to people's standards of living. That's true in most countries. Like, you know, in the U.S., as a working class person, you have access to different kinds of goods for cheaper now than you did in the 1960s. You know, a smartphone is something that was not conceivable back then. That said, the price of other things has risen very unevenly. So at the same time that, personal electronic goods are more accessible, rent is more expensive, healthcare is more expensive, and education is more expensive by significant, significant margins. So what's going on both in this country and in the rest of the developed world and in developing countries is a very, very uneven process of development, both domestically and at the international level. You have these really, really large inequalities that are opening up, and that's really what's driving a lot of the political turmoil that we're experiencing.
It's interesting that all those things, I mean, I'm not sure about healthcare, but certainly education and rent is a matter of property. Intellectual property that are intellectual or otherwise, actually. It's the monopoly capitalists that have been increasing their share of the general wealth, and that's had an impact on working people. But it's not a matter of the commodities. It's not a matter of actual commodities becoming more expensive.
No, broadly, no. I mean, the general trend for most produced commodities is to become cheaper over time. And the interesting thing, and this is really, you know, when I talked about earlier how I was doing this work around tenant organizing and gentrification and that inspiring this book, the thing that I found doing this research is that crisis that you spoke of in the late 60s and early 70s that marked this transition from kind of capitalism focused on post-war industrial investment to an increasingly speculative financial capitalism, that actually is very much, that transition is very much behind the rise of rents and the rise of issues with gentrification all across the world. The drive to invest in, make speculative investments as opposed to productive investments. So investing in real estate, the reason that large capital owners are doing this is because they don't expect to get good profitable returns out of making investments and opening up a new factory. So they know that this is happening for capitalists everywhere. And so what they do is instead they invest in insurance, they invest in, you know, building a luxury condo in a city. And because it's not just this one bank that's investing in luxury condos, but banks all around the world, they know that they can make this investment and hope to sell that building at a later date to another investor for more money, which is what's happening with these real estate bubbles in a lot of these major metropolitan cities. that
even if there aren't very many people who can afford to live in those.
Exactly. And the problem that I realized we were encountering is that it actually didn't matter for these companies whether or not they were building luxury condos that people came to live in. It was not actually about charging that rent in the first place, even though it did actually drive up rents in the neighborhood and further this process of gentrification. It was about a much larger process related to the health of global capitalism as a whole. And that is something that I think is really problematic for the left, because the way that our struggles are focused at such a local level naturally, it can be very difficult to find ways to intervene where we can meaningfully make an impact in these global processes.
The difficulty that people were facing, just to put it really simply, was not a matter of greedy landlords. Like, let's say you're talking about San Francisco, let's say you're talking about Portland. So I'm in Portland, Oregon, and rents are going up here. Homelessness is becoming a big problem for a variety of reasons. There's a tendency to blame Californians and the tech industry, saying, oh, because the people in the tech industry are making so much money, and then they move to Portland, and then the people build these condos for them, and that brings up the rent for everybody, and that's gentrification. You're saying that, in fact, it's not the Californians' fault. There may be some people moving who have a lot of wealth. And by the way, they're coming from a sector that relies on intellectual property, the tech sector. But it may be that that's happening. But the truth is that it's the actual process of speculative investment in real estate that's creating this rent spike and creating this hardship for everyday people living in a city.
Yeah, both things play a role. So when you talk about the greedy landlord, there really are greedy landlords. They're just plugging into the process that is happening, whether they do it or not. So in the community we were working in Brooklyn, you have individual landlords who engaged in horrible abuses to try to drive people out of apartments because they knew that if they did manage to do this, they would be able to sell their land to real estate developers.
Right, right. There's an incentive problem there too. I mean, it's not – I guess one way to try to change the situation would just be to screen the landlords. You can't own land unless you have a certain level of moral psychology. but that seemed like a losing proposition to try to step in on that level, especially when there's so much – I mean, you might find these people's morality changed once they took the job.
And that's the whole point of having a sort of structural critique and a structural understanding of capitalism is understanding that even though people have all these human foibles and things that come out when they're placed in a position where they can profit from being greedy and unscrupulous, it's really the larger system as a whole that's creating the incentives for people to act in this way. And also essentially forcing people who are, you know, might still make bad decisions, but, you know, your capitalist doesn't just introduce a technology that's going to lay off a bunch of workers because they're a bad person. They do that because there's other firms that are competing with them as well, that if they don't make that introduction, they'll go out of business. So we're kind of all stuck in this sort of, mutual... It's kind of like a mutual standoff game, if you will, where everybody is forced to do the worst possible things to each other in order to survive as capital continues to centralize and centralize.
How have you maintained your confidence in the working class to tackle these structural problems that don't immediately appear to them on the level of a personal struggle? It often immediately appears as a personal struggle for them, but the forces that they're fighting against are so much larger than them and often invisible that it seems like it would get directed in a variety of other directions. And also that there would be a tendency amongst the working class to, rather than struggle for a structural change that wouldn't benefit everyone, to consider the problem in very, very personal terms. Like, okay, I need to move out of this sector of work and into another sector, or I need to keep immigrants out.
Yeah, I mean, people really do respond to these kind of pressures that are really being placed on all of us in a variety of different ways. And, you know, all of us at some level is hustling to get by, unless you happen to have, an amazing trust fund and you can just live off that, in which case you're still a part of the capitalist system. You're just the beneficiary. No, we're all doing what we can to get by. And there's always going to be that individual element of trying to figure out a way that, you know, I'm going to be able to, and the people who I love are going to be able to eat every night. That's just a reality. But the ways that people react to the things that are happening to them, I think on the one hand, there is a lot of misattribution. The hatred towards immigrants and refugees that's just mushroomed all over the world is the principal example of this. The rise of ultranationalism and fascism again is a huge problem. And it's a social mechanism that does not have the potential to solve any of the problems that we're facing. That said, I think a lot of people, even people who also have racist attitudes or patriarchal attitudes, also understand that they are being exploited by some group of people. It might not have the most clear idea of, you know, who these people are or how this, you know, economic mechanism is occurring, but people know that they're getting screwed.
That sometimes transforms into like anti-Semitism. They're being screwed over by some secret group of elites. Unless you have a really well worked out structural analysis that at least seems close to right, I think you're going to look for answers on the realm of the personal and the political and on the realm of heroes and villains rather than systems and societies.
That is true. And at the same time, I mean, again, you can have the thing that I've learned through organizing, and I'm by no means an expert, is that you encounter people who, individuals who by themselves have the most contradictory opinions. You encounter people who are very easily pushed to be anti-capitalist and at the same time have opinions that are racist or anti-Semitic or whatever, just because of the kind of environment that they live in and the kind of media that they consume. It happens all the time. I think what gives me hope is that there have been many movements throughout history where people, you know, whether or not they have this, you know, academic understanding of capitalism that we all laud, and which, by the way, we as radical scholars or Marxist thinkers constantly get wrong, despite being very, very happy with our own models and ideas.
That's for damn sure.
Many people who were not even literate have had the capacity to understand enough about the things that are going on around them to take action and to come together in a common project to try to improve things. And if you look at the history of most revolutionary movements throughout history, a lot of them didn't start out with people saying, all right, we want to change every single thing in our society and turn over a completely new leaf. People started with a sort of reactive reformist idea. They said, we want this thing that's being done to us to stop. We want a certain improvement in our living standards. But they unleashed a project, a process that was much bigger than what they had intended initially. And really, that's my hope. I think that we have a lot of people, especially in this country, who are feeling not particularly well served by the current system, who are very much dejected from it. There are negative trends as well, absolutely. But we do have the capacity to see some kind of change. It's a question of whether we have the strategy to actually turn that discontent into something real.